All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.
Hello, listeners. Welcome once again to another episode of All the Rage here on Trax FM. Thank you very much for your time. And during these difficult periods, as ever, we wish you all help, solidarity and love around the world. I hope you're getting through these difficult times. I'm very pleased to say that this week I have another guest. So I'm going to hand over to my guests to introduce themselves. Good evening, guests. Please introduce yourself to the public.
Thank you for having me. My name is Mirza Saib Beg. I am a Kashmiri lawyer and I am currently studying at the University of Oxford for a degree in public policy.
I've always noted this in my questions. I say a quick history of the region of Kashmir. I'm not so sure it's quick. Could you please give us a little history of the region of Kashmir, please?
Sure. So Jammu and Kashmir is a territory in Central Asia. It is located between India, Pakistan and China. The point where these three countries intersect is the point where Kashmir is located. And it is a region that remains colonized and occupied. But the conflict in Kashmir is for a simple reason, which is that the people have been denied the right to decide the future of this region. And the reason for this consistent denial is because the oppressors who deny this right already know the answer of the referendum. And it is an answer that they do not want to hear. The conflict has now been the subject of a long-standing international dispute, which is under intensive military occupation. It is a theater for armed conflict, and it is a conflict that has led, that has left about 100,000 people dead just in the last 30 years alone. And in the last 73, 74 years, as many as 300,000, 400,000 people have been killed in this conflict. So the last 1 year has been a ramification of aggression, of state aggression, after the Indian government had unilaterally and illegally disintegrated the state. And they also eliminated India's only Muslim majority state. They cancelled the Indian state's separate constitution because Jammu and Kashmir state, which was under Indian administration, had its own constitution, its own flag, its own head of state. So all of these things were cancelled and we were depoliticized and disempowered by various amendments of the Indian government. And right now there are plans to divide this territory into further divisions in a way to sort of gerrymander the boundaries of Kashmir so that the Indian government can divide the Muslim majority region into manageable populations of Muslims. So earlier we had Jammu and Kashmir. Jammu had a majority Hindu population and Kashmir has a majority Muslim population. But the entire state is a majority Muslim state. So by dividing it up, the population is now going to be centered towards a Hindu identity. And by the process of gerrymandering, which is known as delimitation in Kashmir, they will increase the electoral seats for the Jammu region, which has a more Hindu population. So in effect, they are going to take away political power from the Muslim population of the state. And it is a complete disenfranchisement for the Muslims of this region. There's also a legalization of a denial to Muslims to claim this this area as a territory where they own the right to property, where they have the right to certain government benefits, employment. And the Indian government is dismantling Kashmir's land ownership system under which land in Kashmir was not available to non-Kashmiris, that is Indians in this case. But now Indians will be allowed to buy land in Kashmir. They'll be allowed to invest into Kashmir to take over the local economy. And the preference will be given to them. So in effect, Kashmiris will, all structures of local autonomy and power that Kashmiris had is being dismantled right now. So there's been an annexation, there's been a bifurcation, there's been a degradation from a state to a union territory. And what we're seeing now is a delimitation. So these are the broadly the things that are happening right now. Before 1947, just to give you a bird's eye view, Kashmir has been governed by various kinds of rulers. There have been the Mughals, there have been the Afghans, the Sikhs, the Dogras. And in all of these, the Kashmiri identity has always maintained itself as a unique identity because we see ourselves as a people. We see ourselves as an identity unique in the subcontinent. And that identity has survived centuries now. And that identity, the people that believe in this identity, they demand a referendum. They demand the right of self-determination. They demand the right to decide their own future, whether we want to be with India, with Pakistan, or independent. That is a decision which the people of Kashmir have the right to make. And there has been a consistent denial of that right, despite there being United Nations resolutions, there being a whole history of jurisprudence on this issue, a history of diplomacy on this issue. But that is the fundamental question in Kashmir, that will the people of Kashmir be treated as equal human beings and be given the right to have the most basic of human rights, which is the right to choose our future? And that denial has resulted in various forms of protest, some which have been armed protest and some which have been unarmed protest, mass civilian mobilization. And it's mostly unarmed. It's mostly a non-violent protest that has gone on over nearly a century now. But fundamentally, that is the issue at hand over here.
So just on the referendum front, you mentioned that. Is that like an active kind of political campaign now to have a referendum? And what would that look like? What would the kind of question or questions be within a referendum on this?
Well, there already is a resolution which has been passed by the United Nations on a plebiscite, which gives the option of to Kashmiris to choose either India or Pakistan as a future. But there's also a demand in many circles in Kashmir to have an independent state. So a referendum would look like we will have all three options on the cards, that whether Kashmiris want to remain with India, whether they want to be independent, or whether they want to merge with Pakistan. And depending on where people have their allegiances, they will tell you that one particular brand has, or one particular ideology in this is the majority of amongst them. But no one really has conducted an independent and free survey, because all sides of Kashmir are not accessible to every person. You see, the territory of Kashmir, a part of it is controlled by Pakistan right now, a part of it is controlled by India, and a part of it is controlled by China. So there is, it's very difficult to have a survey for all these regions. And often when people talk to political commentators, they are very conscious of the fact that this interview or this information may be relayed to the governments, to the local government, which might then prosecute them or persecute them based on what they have said. So they're rarely conducted freely. So until people are given the choice to freely exercise their political will, the referendum cannot take place, and no one can claim that they know what is best for the Kashmiris except the Kashmiris. So that is what the referendum would look like. The reason the United Nations resolution does not give an option of independence is because at the time of the partition of the subcontinent, when Pakistan was formed and India was formed, there was an ideology that believed that the people of this region have two options, that either they become part of India or of Pakistan. But Kashmiris, by and large, the leadership at that time wanted an independent option. In fact, even the Maharaja, the king of Kashmir at that time, he was in favor of an independent state. But he was an unpopular ruler, and there was a popular revolt going on against him. So our political trajectory was moving more towards having a constitutional monarchy in place. The Maharaja would abdicate his powers, but remain the Maharaja, the king, whereas we would have an elected government in place, and we would probably have become a constitutional monarchy. But that's not how things panned out. And the Indian and Pakistani forces, they engaged each other. There was a war that was fought. And at the end of it, Pakistan controlled the two parts of Kashmir, Gilgit-Baltistan and what Pakistan calls Azad Kashmir, and what India calls Pakistan-occupied Kashmir. But the United Nations calls that region Pakistan-administered Kashmir, and they call the region that India controls as Indian-administered Kashmir. And I am from the region which is known as Indian-administered Kashmir. I'm from Srinagar. So that's what a referendum or a plebiscite would ideally look like, where every option is given to the Kashmiri people and we decide then which way we want to go.
And do you think I think democratically speaking, it's very important to have a referendum like this. But were the result to be, for instance, independence, do you have any idea of what that would look like and how likely it is to happen? I mean, if the area already has military intervention into it, etc., are those parties likely to really just get the message, get up and leave?
No, it's unlikely that the parties would just get the message and get up and leave. But it is for the nation states around us to decide that, because there is no long-term policy for demilitarization, neither from Pakistan nor from India. So the only long-term, the policy that India has in Kashmir right now will only lead towards more conflict. So it is for Indians to ask their governments how long they think it is feasible to have these armies stationed there. See, Kashmir is right now the world's most densely militarized zone. And I mean that statistically, not as a figure of speech. Even Iraq and Afghanistan at the heights of the US invasion were not this militarized. There are as anything between 500,000 to 700,000 troops in Kashmir right now. Troops, paramilitary forces, police, armed men from the government. So it's a heavily, it's an obscene presence of armies and gunmen in Kashmir. So it's difficult for them to just get the message and leave. But that is the only way you can have a peaceful resolution of this dispute. If you allow the people of Kashmir to express their will, and then governments have to create space for that and respect that. If the people of Kashmir decide that they choose to go with Pakistan, then both the governments have to respect that. If the people of Kashmir choose to become a part of India, which I feel is highly unlikely given the magnitude of human rights violations, the process of depoliticization, rigging of elections, everything that we have endured over the last 72 years, 73 years, it is highly unlikely that a majority of Kashmiris would vote for that. And it is established that the people who are in Pakistan-administered Kashmir do not have any desire of merging with India. They may have a desire of merging with Pakistan or becoming independent. So like I said earlier, that no one can truly predict which way a referendum will go, because this referendum has never really been held. And we are at a point right now where the Indian government has magnified and has become so aggressive towards its policies in Kashmir, towards demographic change and changing the entire identity of Kashmir, what it means to be a Kashmiri, and who gets to participate in this referendum, that right now to debate over which side it would go towards seems to be quite futile, because there are three sides to this. And ideally speaking, it is for the Kashmiris to, for India and Pakistan, it is just to their responsibility to uphold the right to self-determination and let Kashmiris express themselves freely as any people would. You see, when Scotland had a referendum in the UK, no democratic nation will go to war against people that it calls its own. The only way to resolve such issues are by way of democratic expression, and that is not being allowed over there. So when that is being permitted, only then will we know which way it can go.
Do you think, or is there any sense that there is a bit of a wider political, I hate to use the word use, but I do feel a little like Kashmir and Kashmiris are being used in a kind of proxy conflict between China and India or anything like that? Or is that just not, that's not relevant?
Well, you see, Kashmir has been used. In fact, the import of the term, the word used over here is quite appropriate. Kashmir has been used by India, by Pakistan, and by world powers based on where it suits their foreign policy interests. In the 1990s, when the armed movement in Kashmir, the armed movement for freedom was at its peak, India's prime minister came to Kashmir and said that he would be willing to give any kind of autonomy. Sky is the limit is what he said at that time. And that time India was at a very weak point, probably one of their weakest in recent history, where their currency had completely devalued, the gold reserves had plummeted. So they were economically in a very weak position, and they had lost a lot of morale and control in Kashmir. A lot of human rights violations had taken place, mass rape had taken place, mass incarceration, disappearances of people. So they had completely lost the moral ground, if at all there was ever was any. And at that point, India felt, and in Kashmir, we felt that this is it. This is the end of militancy and the end of the armed occupation of Kashmir. However, that's when India opened up its economy. They liberalized, so to say, and they allowed McDonald's to come in and big companies, US companies to come in, which were not allowed until then. The Indian market was a closed market. And soon after that, you saw a turn in global policy towards India, global attitude towards India. India was presented as a massive market. And this is not the first time it has happened. Whenever around the world, countries have wanted to arm twist India, they have always used Kashmir to get their way because they know that India is very weak on this. Similarly, other countries also have tried to use Kashmir based on their foreign policy interests. For example, in the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, there are 58 countries over there. And there is a committee which debates issues of Kashmir. I believe it has Nigeria, Azerbaijan, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Malaysia, and maybe Turkey as well. So these are countries that are based in this group. But often the countries will take a position on Kashmir based on their foreign policy interests. If it is in their favor to have trade and ties with India, then they will not want to harm that relationship because Kashmir is a very sensitive issue for India. And Indians also know that this is a platform and an argument on which they are very weak. Because if you just scratch beneath the surface, the democracy, the judicial structure, the access to justice, everything that Indians are proud of their nation, about creating a secular country, an independent nation, a republic, you know, a country that gives treats people equally before the law, all of that falls flat when you examine these arguments on Kashmir. So what have you actually created then if you cannot give people equal rights before the law, if you cannot guarantee freedom of speech, if you cannot guarantee a truly democratic society? Because the moment Kashmiris criticize or raise their voice against what is happening there, they're often jailed. In fact, in this year, there have been terrorist, anti-terror legislations which have been invoked against journalists for uploading photos to Facebook. Masrat Zahra is a female photojournalist from Kashmir. She in fact won a lot of awards this year for her journalism and for her photography. So she was charged with the UAPA, which is the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act. It is an anti-terror legislation under which you can be jailed for up to 7 years. And her crime was uploading photos to her personal profile. And these were photos which were already published in reputed media outlets around the world, such as Al Jazeera, New York Times, Washington Post. And it's well acknowledged around in many media circles. So this was not something which was truly anti-state or truly or encouraging terrorism in any way. She was disseminating information and not really taking a position on whether this is right or wrong. But these are people who have also been charged with UAPA in order to intimidate them. And often newspapers are raided in Kashmir. They get confiscated, sometimes banned from publication if they have written something which is not palatable to the government. So when you create such a society, and you have clear examples that young children, 12-year-old kids are being arrested under the Public Safety Act. In fact, I personally had come across one case where a 14-year-old boy had been charged with under the Public Safety Act. And the peculiar thing about this act is that once you are charged with it, you cannot be represented. You don't even come before a court. You are taken before an administrative committee, and they decide on the future of how you are to be dealt with. But often people spend at least 6 months to 2 years in detention under the Public Safety Act. And once they come out, a new Public Safety Act order is imposed on them. So this is known as the revolving door arrests in Kashmir. So you come out of one door, you go back in jail, come out again, you go back. In fact, there are some people like Masrat Alam who has spent nearly 27, 28 years in detention like this. So these acts are draconian. And by any measure of civil society, civilized society, these laws should have been outlawed a long time ago. They should have been struck down. But they exist in Kashmir to ban the circulation of people, because those people are a threat to the propaganda of the Indian government. They challenge the authority and the legitimacy of the Indian government in Kashmir. So to ban their circulation, they have these laws in place. And I came across one case where a 14-year-old boy had been charged under the Public Safety Act. And the order of this particular case, it read that this boy is a threat to peace and security and the sovereignty of this nation. So a 14-year-old boy has been charged with being a threat to the sovereignty or the integrity of the nation. It is quite laughable. And there are many people who are juveniles who are often arrested in Kashmir. So when you have this structure in place, then it is questionable as to how a people would ever want to be a part of this structure that denies them equal participation. It denies them being treated as human beings, because if Kashmiri people have a particular will or a particular political view, it is absolutely disregarded. In fact, in the last year when the annexation of Kashmir took place, we were not consulted at any point of time. We have not been asked if this is what we want. And if we have not been asked, then how is it democratic? If it is not democratic, then it must be an autocratic imposition of power. And you cannot really reason with the government when the moment you ask questions or challenge what they have done, you will be put in detention or in jail, such as many people have been. The president of Jammu and Kashmir's Bar Association, he's the president of the lawyers body, the Bar Association of Kashmir. He has been in jail for a whole year. He was just released a few days ago after spending 1 year in detention for thought crimes. In fact, when the case came up for hearing before the High Court said that his ideology is problematic. It's not about an action that he has committed, and you will be hard pressed to find a regime around the world that punishes people for their thoughts and not for actions that they have committed. But this is the president of the Bar Association. He's well over 70 years old. There were many petitions, many arguments made in court, especially during COVID times, that he is at risk. He's a senior citizen. There's a lack of healthcare facilities in the jail. And he even suffered a cardiac arrest at one point of time. However, he was not released at all until the government felt it okay to do so. And he is just one of the hundreds and thousands of cases which are similar, except that they are not as well known as he would be. And this is how they've been treated. So since last 1 year, we have seen an escalation of aggression in Kashmir. And mostly this is being done to colonize our resources without the facade of any local leadership.
I'm slightly taken aback. I don't really know how to respond to this. I'm really quite taken aback on that.
No, it's okay. I know, because you know, often when people are exposed to what is happening in Kashmir, it is so shocking that such things can take place in any modern society today. That young children, minors are being arrested. Rape has taken place so many times over. And in fact, I can give you some cases as well of that, where even after 30 years of mass rape having taken place, the perpetrators have never been punished in any court, despite all the human rights violations that have taken place in Kashmir in the last 30 years. There's hardly a single member of the Indian Armed Forces who's serving a jail sentence anywhere. And often the Indian government claims that these are all fake claims. All of these cases, all of the human rights violations are just fake. But now, over the last few years, the magnitude of these cases has become so much that it is becoming hard for them to deny that these human rights violations have taken place. So now we see a new argument emerging from Indian circles, where they accept that, yes, human rights violations have taken place in Kashmir. And there are many United Nations reports also. In fact, last year, two reports came out by the United Nations, one the year before and one last year, on what human rights violations have taken place in Kashmir. And it has now become hard for Indians to deny it. But we are actually at an even worse off position right now, because now they justify it. Earlier, they were denying the very existence of it, which made us feel that at least they have a conscience at some point that they feel that these things don't happen. But now when they accept that they happen and they are justifying them, saying that, yes, because if you don't teach these people a lesson, then they will demand for a breakup of India or demand for independence. And what if other states in India also ask for similar forms of independence? Then what will we do? So they fear the balkanization of India. And my question to them is that if you have created a country that everyone wants to leave, doesn't that expose the greater flaws of this democratic structure that you've created, as opposed to creating a structure that where everyone feels so protected and so included into this structure that you have, that they would never want to leave this opportunity in terms of human potential, in terms of nation building that you present them within your structure? But because everyone has been treated so unfairly that everyone feels that given the option, anyone would leave.
So I was just thinking about the notion of if you don't suppress these people, they'll demand independence. Like, where have I heard that before? I've heard that one a few times over the years. I'd like to move on to media, but I just want, while we're on the subject of legality, I just want to ask you a couple of other parts here. While I was reading an article you wrote, you mentioned Article 35A of the Indian Constitution and its relevance to Kashmir. Could you give us a bit of detail about that and why it's relevant?
Well, it's really relevant right now because the Indian government is trying to engineer forcible demographic changes in Kashmir so that they can change the meaning of what it means to be a Kashmiri. You see, in the future, if there ever would have been a referendum or a plebiscite on Kashmir, it would be the Kashmiris who would vote on that. But if you change the very definition of who can be a Kashmiri, then the referendum is rendered, it is frustrated before it has even taken place. So the historical background that is needed to, that I can just touch upon to make a distinction between where Article 35 came from. You see, in 1927, a notification was sought to provide certain privileges to permanent residents in Kashmir, especially for the purchase of land and employment. And this was actually agitated for by the Hindus of Kashmir, because they were worried about people coming from a region outside Kashmir, which was known as Punjab. And those people were coming to Kashmir and taking over their jobs and buying land. So the Hindus agitated and they asked for special protections. And the king at that time had, he passed a notification through which he protected the rights of the permanent residents of Kashmir, which included mostly the Hindu population of Kashmir. And through this notification, only a permanent resident of Kashmir could buy land in Kashmir or could get certain kinds of government employment in Kashmir. Now, after 1947, when India was formed and Kashmir came under Indian administration, the Indian government also passed a presidential order and they retained the structure of this 1927 notification. So Article 35A of the Indian Constitution recognized, number one, that the legislature of Kashmir will define who the permanent resident is. And anyone who was identified as a permanent resident was given a certificate of residence, which entitled them to special benefits relating to employment, scholarships, and certain other privileges. But the biggest advantage for permanent residents is that it is only they who have the right to own and buy property in the state. And all of those people who had been living in the state on 14th of May 1954, which is when this law came into effect, all the people who had lived in the state for 10 years since then were counted as permanent residents. And this is not just an article in the Indian Constitution. A similar provision is also in the Constitution of Kashmir, which is Section 6, under which we have again reiterated the same thing, that it is only Kashmiri legislature which will define who can be a permanent resident. Now, a question might arise in someone's mind that why are there two provisions in two separate constitutions saying the same thing? It is because both of these were meant to bind the legal structures of their respective countries. Article 35A was meant to bind the courts of India from ever interfering in Kashmir over what rights we give to our people for the land, for property benefits, what we do in Kashmir. So we were creating two separate structures of governance. And Kashmir had, under the agreements with India, Kashmir was supposed to have a separate legislature, separate legal system, separate constitution, a separate flag. So it was going to be more or less a country within a country if that structure had been upheld and if it had been accepted by a referendum. But that didn't happen. And over time, India kept trying to encroach upon powers which we had retained for ourselves. We were supposed to have a prime minister in Kashmir, and we had one till 1964, after which the Indian government engineered an amendment by which we ceased to have a prime minister. We started having the chief minister. So every agreement that we have had with the Indian government till now has been violated by them. In 1952, there had been a Delhi agreement with the leadership of India. And even that they violated, because these instruments and these articles, they recognize the right of Kashmir to define its own citizens, which we used to call them state subjects because we were a monarchy before 1947. And the new rules which are being passed by the government of India, they have de-operationalized all of this. So now the new rules grant the eligibility of domicile to new classes of Indians, which includes central government employees, Indian armed forces, their children, Anyone who meets the eligibility criteria of having lived in Kashmir for 15 years or having served the Indian government for 10 years or having been educated in Kashmir for 7 years. All of these people are eligible to become domiciles of Kashmir. So they will now be given opportunities in employment. They will now be given opportunities in education in Kashmir. So effectively, the child of an Indian citizen is eligible to become a Kashmiri, to become a domicile of Kashmir, even if that child has never lived in Kashmir. And through this, they are going to try to engineer a demographic change in Kashmir. And it will also further complicate the situation of Kashmir. Because you see, assume 30 years down the line, 40 years down the line, these non-Kashmiris, these Indians who come and reside in Kashmir, they will have become a part of society. And at that time, if we ever have a referendum, and if these people are not, there can only be two options. Either these people will also be given a right to participate in that referendum, or they will be denied that right. Now, if they are denied the right of referendum and Kashmiris choose to be independent or they choose to become a part of Pakistan, what will happen to these people then? Do we envisage a situation where we have to fight against them then? Because they would not want to be a part of Pakistan because they're Indians who are coming there. So you end up creating a more complex situation. The other thing is that Kashmir is a war zone. So no sensible Indian is going to move into Kashmir with their family and children. So it is mostly going to be ex-army officers who are moving in. But gradually they will try to create militarized structures for colonies that they set up inside Kashmir, which will be guarded by the 500,000, 700,000 strong force that India has in Kashmir. So you're actually creating a more volatile situation. And if armed rebellion resumes in Kashmir at the levels where it was in the 1990s, then it is bound to result in possible attacks on these spaces. And when that happens, you will polarize the society even more. And these attacks and the deaths of the people who come there, non-Kashmiris who come there, will be used as political fodder to create the image of a regressive Kashmiri who needs to be treated or confronted with oppressive means in order to teach them the values of democracy and modernity. So that's what the Indian government wants right now. They want to engineer chaos. They don't want resolution of this issue. They want more chaos in this issue. Because if there's more chaos, then the situation is polarized and finding a solution becomes more complicated.
Specifically on the residence issue, I think you answered some of this in your last answer, but I'd like to just elaborate on it a little more. Why might a Kashmiri resident be unable to obtain a proof of residence in the present climate?
Well, right now, for an Indian who feels eligible for domicile in Kashmir, there's a host of documents that they can produce. They can get a letter from their employer. They can show an electricity bill or rental bills, which prove that they've lived in Kashmir for a certain number of years to make them eligible. They can show the school certificates. They can show a bunch of documents, an Aadhaar card, which is like an identification card in India. So they can show a host of documents to get eligibility to be called domiciles in Kashmir. But for Kashmiris, we only have one document truly to show that we are domiciled, which is our permanent residence certificate. And these are the certificates which were issued from 1954 onwards. Most Kashmiris have this certificate. But you see, we also have many vulnerable populations in the state who live in abject poverty. And many of them do not have appropriate documentation to prove that they are permanent residents. So if they cannot prove that they are permanent residents, they will be forced to leave Kashmir in search of employment or in search of education for their children. The other thing is Kashmir, we have seen many cases where because of political vendetta, people who are not palatable to the government are put through more harassment. So whether by design of this new law or whether by malice, if any Kashmiri does not get this proof of residence, they will be forced to leave Kashmir. So there are many reasons why we feel that it'll be difficult for us. And we also feel that the process being online, it is difficult for us to monitor who is getting the domicile certificates, how are they being used, what rights are being given to them. So this is why we feel that it'll be difficult for Kashmiris to obtain them. But as of now, when I had written that article, the domicile law had just been announced. And now it has been almost 4 or 5 months since the law was implemented. And in these last few months, nearly 200,000 people have been given domicile certificates. So it doesn't look like anyone has been denied a domicile certificate as of now. But if the government were to wage a political vendetta against anyone, this would be an easy tool to utilize. Because the moment you are considered, maybe if your documentation is considered to be incomplete, or if your documentation has been lost, because we had a flood in Kashmir a few years ago. We also had a massive earthquake in Kashmir some years before that. So a lot of people have lost property documents, identity documents, passports, and the bureaucratic process of recreating those documents is quite hectic. So many people do not have appropriate documentation. That does not mean that they are not Kashmiri. That means they don't have the documents. But how the government will choose to respond to them is completely their call then. So you are at the mercy of the government. And this is not a government that necessarily wants to work for you. It is hostile towards you. So you are then left at their mercy if they want to give you a domicile certificate or not. And that is why for a Kashmiri resident, in certain cases, it might be difficult to obtain that proof of residence.
Thank you. Could you also please explain the National Register of Citizens Citizens Amendment Act, which I also saw you refer to in your previous article?
Yes. Well, the Citizenship Amendment Act is an act passed by the Government of India, and it creates a privileged class of people who will get a faster option of citizenship. And to qualify in this class, you need to be someone who has been found to be an illegal immigrant in India, and they need to come from Afghanistan, Pakistan, or Bangladesh. And they can be from the religions of Hinduism, Sikhism, Buddhism, Jain, Parsi, or Christian. Now, the issue in this is that if you are an illegal immigrant and not from the religions that they are qualified, then you do not qualify for citizenship. And conspicuously, they have left Muslims out. So if you are Muslim and found to be an illegal immigrant, you do not qualify. But same is the case if you are Tibetan escaping Chinese aggression, or if you are Tamil from Sri Lanka. So now the NRC CAA exercise affects Kashmir as well, because the Indian government has said that passports, PAN cards, Aadhaars, voter cards, they are not a proof of citizenship. So even it seems that even state subject might not be accepted, but there is no clarity on how it will apply in Kashmir right now. As of now in Kashmir, we are working on the domicile law. But it appears that Kashmiris, that birth certificates will be the only document that they will rely on. And many Kashmiris do not have those documents. As I mentioned, vulnerable people, people living in the streets, people who have been affected by natural calamities, or even people with a slight difference in the spelling of their name. Because we have seen this happen in Assam, which is a state in India, where some people who had a different spelling in their name, in some cases, Ahmed was written with an E, A-H-M-E-D, or Ahmed was written with an A, where A-H-M-A-D. And these became two completely different people, and one was considered to be an illegal immigrant because his name was spelled differently in different documents. Now, coming from a first world country, you may think that this is a glaring error, but in India, these things happen very frequently. Many, many people, especially people, because you see, we are talking about populations that are largely illiterate. They do not read their documents. So because they come from extremely vulnerable backgrounds, where they are living on less than ₹4, $4, $2-3 a day. So it's a very vulnerable population, and this clerical error is going to result in rejections. The transgender community has completely been ignored in this. It affects people who are landless. It affects people who come from lower castes in India, because they are the vulnerable populations and often they don't have any land. So it's very difficult for such populations to establish their identity. And this, again, does not mean that they are illegal immigrants or they are not citizens. It just means that they do not have the documents, because India has never worked on these people. These are the invisible people. These are the people who clean cars in India, come to work in people's homes, live and sleep on the streets. This is the invisible population that is right there in front of everyone, but the governments have never really done anything about them. And now they're expecting these people who barely have any means to get by, who never know where their next meal will come from, whether they will even have a meal tomorrow. They expect these people to have documentation of their identity. It's not going to happen. So it just is a glaring observation on what the priorities of the Indian government are. And what they're doing is now through this exercise, if there are Hindus who are found, who are undocumented, they will get to go through the CAA process and apply as illegal immigrants and they will become citizens. But if there are Muslims who are found in this process who are undocumented, they will not have any option because Muslims have been left out of the whole process. So if you are Muslim and found to be an illegal immigrant, you do not qualify.
So what happens to you? Where do you go if you're a Muslim in this situation?
There are lots of internment centers that have been set up all over India. A lot of mainstream media has already covered this in great detail. There are big camps that they have set up where these people are supposed to be sent to. And already there are a few camps existing which have a couple of 1,000 people in them who have been found to be illegal immigrants. And then there are courts that have been set up separately to deal with the process that if you want to appeal. But under the current numbers, it will take at least 8 to 10 years to discharge all the pending cases of the people that they have found. So the process is not meant to identify people who are not illegal immigrants. It is meant to harass people. It is meant to subject you to mental, emotional harassment. In fact, one of the cases is that of an ex-army officer who has been found to be an illegal immigrant. There's also a case of the family of the ex-president of India. His family has been found to be illegal immigrants because some spelling of their name was incorrect. So these people are then sent to these camps until they can prove themselves to be citizens. And eventually they will become a part of the informal sector, informal economy of India, where these people do not have to be given minimum wages then until they prove their citizenship. These people can be treated in any manner that is deemed fit because they are the second class population in India then. And eventually when they come out of this process, they will be so broken and so fatigued that any chance of revolution from them is unexpected. It's not going to happen then. And the government is basically now going to create a different class of citizenship for such people.
It does seem not exactly odd or strange, but worrying that within the context of law, perhaps even international law, India is able to proceed in this way. And I do wonder, is there anything legally where, you know, I've discussed Kashmir, as I said to you earlier, it's not a region I knew a tremendous amount about before we began this evening, but I've discussed it with some people I know of Indian heritage. And some of them are quite hard line on their viewpoints of a kind of ownership or of the area. And I wonder if that comes from a purely cultural level or is there also, frankly, the international law appears to be letting all of this pass by. Is that two separate questions really, or do you think there's a connection with what I'm saying?
Well, there is a connection. International law is a toothless form of law. Unless countries want to impose sanctions on an errant country, nothing can really be done. The United Nations has already deliberated on Kashmir. They already have passed what they feel is the right way forward, but it has not been implemented. And once you have a situation where countries do not want to abide by what has been accepted, what has been passed as a resolution, what do you do next? You can either go to war against that country or you can impose sanctions. And neither of those can be done now because of the economic interests involved. India is a massive market, so very few countries would want to ruin their relationship with India. But I also feel that there is, in terms of international media, there is a confusion over Kashmir. There is definitely a silence because Kashmir is not seen to be important enough for global issues. We don't have oil in Kashmir, but it is a nuclear flashpoint. And now even China is involved in the dispute. Pakistan and India have already been fighting, with they fought many wars over Kashmir. But in the last few months, the Chinese and Indian armies have also engaged with each other, which has resulted in the deaths of at least 20 Indian soldiers in just one such incident. And some media has even claimed that the number is as high as 50 soldiers being killed. So they are on the brink of a war right now. And any misstep can lead to a war from three sides, between India, Pakistan and China. All three of them are nuclear armed nations. So the global community, the United Nations, international organizations, countries around the world must take this very seriously. But it doesn't seem to be happening because of economic and vested interests. But wherever there's a discourse on Kashmir, the language is mostly, it couches Kashmir as if it were just a human rights issue, without talking about what is causing the human rights violations. What is it that the Kashmiris are asking for that is causing human rights violations? And that is where the intellectual dishonesty over Kashmir plays a role. Because you must look at the etymology and not just the effect of something. Because even if human rights violations stop in Kashmir, it doesn't mean that the issue of Kashmir has been resolved. Kashmir has human rights violations taking place, but fundamentally, it is a political issue that requires concrete political solutions. It's not a bilateral issue between India and Pakistan, and it's definitely not an internal matter for India. It is a threat to regional and global security. Considering India's, Pakistan's, and China's established record of hostile engagement. So given that the stakes are so high over here, we're talking about nearly 2.5 billion people, considering the populations of China, India, and Pakistan, that will be at risk in case of a war between these three nations. It is extremely important for the global community to throw their weight behind a peaceful solution which can be acceptable to the Kashmiri people. And the best way forward in this is to throw their weight behind self-determination. Let the Kashmiri people decide on what should be done over here. But the moment they take a stand like that, it harms their economic interests. And that is why very little is being done. In fact, the United Nations has the power to refer this dispute to the International Court for an advisory opinion. But they have never done that. They have passed resolutions on Kashmir, and those resolutions have never been followed by the countries concerned. And after that, they have never passed any sanctions because of veto powers, because of the interests that will be harmed in case of in case such sanctions are passed, because there's tremendous investment going on in India. It's one of the fastest emerging economies in that part of the world. So there's a lot of money that we're talking about over here. It, human rights have become a very transactional concept in international relations right now. Unless you countries see real tangible benefits emerging from a particular moral position that they take, they don't support those moral positions. So it's all very transactional. And in international law, there's only so far that we can go right now. We are not a recognized state ourselves, so we cannot file a case before an international tribunal. But there are other countries that can file on behalf of Kashmir, which has also not been done for similar reasons. So this is why I feel that international law is largely toothless. And even if a case were to be filed, the verdict of the international court is not necessarily binding on India unless India submits to the jurisdiction of that court. So it's a very complex issue. And it seems that these countries are pushing Kashmiris more towards a war because we have tried peaceful means for 70 years now. And when non-violent and peaceful means are not adhered to or not, they don't yield any results. When you don't listen and you don't give them any audience, you push a people towards taking more other means of protest. And already in Kashmir, we see civilians coming out. They use stones, they use whatever they can get their hands on to protest. And often they are unarmed, where they come out and they face all kinds of weapons from the Indian government. There are new weapons being tested on Kashmir on every other protest. Sometimes they use these chili grenades, which cause inflammation in the lungs and irritation, and they were extremely uncomfortable for everyone around. They sometimes use pellet guns, which have caused mass blinding in the population in Kashmir. And it's probably the only country in the world that has blinded so many people who have come out to protest against human rights violations. And in some cases, they just use brute force and arrest people, arrest young kids. So in the face of such oppression and such tremendous violations, Kashmiris are faced with a very bleak future because we do not see any great support from the international community. And we feel that the least we can do is shame international actors into acting on Kashmir and asking them to question, how would they want their nations to be remembered? How would you want the UK to be remembered 50 years down the line, where we see that they know what is happening in Kashmir, and yet the UK government sells most of its weapons. Most of the weapons that are bought by the Indian Army are from the UK, and they use this ammunition and weapons in Kashmir. So how would these nations want to be remembered 50 years or 60 years down the line is a question that I feel we should ask the people of those nations. Do they want to be remembered as transactional democracies that just transacted for profit, while those transactions were resulting in the death and destruction of entire populations? Or do they want to be remembered as nations that took a moral stand and stood for what was ethically and morally consistent, and that would place these nations on the right side of history? Because we do not, as Kashmiris, we do not advocate for violent overthrowal or violent means. Our struggle has been an entirely peaceful and democratic struggle. And that is essentially what our struggle is. It is a struggle for democracy. It is a struggle for our democratic voice to be accepted. And we are fully ready to comply with any verdict that comes out of a free referendum. Whichever way it may go, we are fine. That is the future. That is what we have decided. But it has to be a free and fair election, a free and fair referendum, where we get to express our political will. And it is the denial of that political will that is the root cause of the problem that we face. So our main objective in engaging with international audiences, governments outside India and Pakistan and Kashmir, is to make them act on this, to take a hard position. Because you cannot get these governments or these things to happen just by talking to the Indian government. You have to take some action. And if you cannot take any action, then your words are just words. They are hollow. You don't have any intention to following them up, which is what we have seen after 73 years of the United Nations action on Kashmir. There are resolutions passed, but they are meaningless if you don't enforce them.
Do you think that the media, particularly in this part of the world, do they have either a positive or a negative or both effect in creating this situation or allowing things to have got as far as they have, or what do they have any involvement? Because it seems to me like there isn't a tremendous amount in the media in this part of the world that even covers this region. Or if they do, they are perhaps a little kind of dismissive of, oh yeah, you know, there's some conflict going on there, some local thing.
You're absolutely right. Generally, media in the UK or in most of the Western part of the world, Europe, USA, they don't really look at Kashmir as a big issue, because it doesn't seem to figure in the larger game that is being played. Maybe the intervention of China in this dispute now might make some more conversation in international circles, but otherwise it's not of great interest. But we have seen in the last 1 year heightened interest in what is going on in Kashmir, primarily because what the Indian government did was so ghastly and so shocking. They shut down the internet. They shut down all kinds of communication into Kashmir for months. No letters, no email, no internet, no phone call, nothing, no communication for months on an end. So it was so ghastly and so shocking how they had engineered this annexation that around the world, many media houses did comment on it. But like I said, they stopped at just passing a remark on the human rights violation without talking about the larger struggle, which is a struggle for our political will to be respected. And they don't take a position on that. They don't talk about that. They don't talk about the right of self-determination. They don't talk about what the Kashmiris are asking for. What is it that's causing these human rights violations? And that is where they are being intellectually dishonest. That is where they are letting India create an identity of the Kashmiri struggle to paint it as regressive, as Islamized, or as violent. So they get to describe what the struggle is without allowing us the tools to describe what our struggle is about. And Kashmiris believe in a democratic, a truly independent space where people are safe and they can express themselves freely. That is the true idea of a democracy. And what we have been denied is the most basic idea of what it means to be human, which is the power to decide your future, that a power to decide who you want to be ruled by, who you want to be governed by, what is your governance structure like. It is the most inalienable part of being a human and of a democratic space. So that is what we have been denied. And this is rarely highlighted in media in the West, where they focus more on softer issues like just the communication ban, just the fact that internet was shut down, or just the fact that there are human rights violations taking place, without actually talking about the larger political issue that is the cause of all of this.
Mm. Yeah, it seems well, I'm going to perhaps over comment on this issue, but it does annoy me when media does this. It seems quite irresponsible to me to kind of put this way. I feel like they've done this a few times. They do it in Palestine too, to the same degree, and various altercations I've noticed in Latin America over the years, where they just kind of don't really bother giving you the details. I find it very Western-centric, maybe that's the right term, certainly chauvinistic. And it's the causes that, you know, people's, the effects that are having on their real life, which you've kind of explained very well over the last hour or so, is effectively ignored. It's quite appalling, really.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It is, their view is more centered towards what is in the interests of the population over here, without actually giving a proper picture about how the silence of people, even in the UK or around in Western societies, how that silence is aiding and abetting the oppression of people in Kashmir.
Mm. Yes, that's quite correct. So sort of drawing us to a near a close now, how can we support the people of Kashmir from an international perspective? What does effective action look like? You know, anyone's listening to this and they think, this is an issue I want to get involved in, wherever they are in the world, you know?
Well, there are various levels of effective action depending on what resources you have at your disposal. At the very bottom of the pile is where you support Kashmiris. You give them safe spaces to vocalize, to talk, and you try and understand what is happening in Kashmir. At a little higher level is where you talk to your local councillors, your local political groups, your MPs, and try to push them towards taking a position on this and ask them why the UK government is still selling arms if these arms are being used against civilians. Why the UK government has not even included Kashmir in its human rights policy, which was just announced 2 months ago. There's no mention of Kashmir over there. Or why the Conservatives have failed to question the Indian government on this consistent lack of democratic values and freedom in Kashmir. So you can push your local councillors on that. And finally, you can move towards creating more space in media. People have not written, if citizens of these countries write to their local media outlets asking for more coverage on Kashmir or a better understanding, and then those media groups will reach out to experts on Kashmir who can talk and create more awareness. That would be a good starting point. And of course, at every stage, to look for Kashmiris who are working on the ground, who require help and support in terms of advocacy, in terms of financial assistance. Because you see, in the last 1 year, with the internet being completely shut down, even before COVID had started, we were in a lockdown. So our economy has completely collapsed in Kashmir. We have suffered a loss of nearly $5 billion. Over 86% of our tourism has collapsed. 62% of our exports have collapsed. So the entire economy that was dependent on the internet in Kashmir has completely been destroyed. So through various means, people from outside Kashmir can support small businesses in Kashmir by buying handicrafts from them, by supporting the local businesses over there. And hopefully when things are safer and when COVID is not an issue anymore, maybe even travel to Kashmir and meet people there, understand the situation, experience what it is like to be over there. Because it is one of the safest places for tourists, although there is a conflict going on over there. But for tourists, it's a very safe place. So to go there and understand and immerse yourself, connect with people over there. These are the various structures that people can get involved in. And of course, try and read more about Kashmir. Reach out to Kashmiris. I am available on Twitter, on most of my social media handles. I'm happy to answer any questions that people may have on Kashmir if they want to get a better understanding of what is going on over there or things that I may not have been able to cover or do justice to in the last 1 hour. I'm free to answer them. And try and get in touch with Kashmiris. So there's about 1 million Kashmiris in the UK. So that's a very significant number of people. Get in touch with these societies. Look at how you can learn more and how you want to play your role in those societies. Because as people who are British citizens, you have many privileges which Kashmiris will not have. And most of all, you have the privilege of free speech, which I feel people in the UK take these freedoms for granted, and they may not be entirely fully thankful of what they have over here. You can do anything you have with that power, which many Kashmiris cannot because they are on Indian passports studying in the UK or living over here. And there's always this fear of what happens when you go back. If you spoke freely over here, what happens if you were to go back? But that fear does not exist for people who are citizens of this country. So you have to use your privilege and understand that you have a responsibility. You are a party to this conflict because this party, this conflict is partly created by the British government's involvement in this region. In fact, Kashmir was sold in 1846 by the Britishers to the Maharaja. And it was a treaty which sold Kashmiri people as well as the land. So the government of the UK has an onus of responsibility on what is happening in Kashmir. And it's a conflict that will go on unless global powers step in. So there is a responsibility on the citizens of this place as well. So these are the various structures, various levels I feel that people can get involved in on this issue. I would love to talk about the trade union movement also in Kashmir, because often people think that the May Day Revolution was one of the first protests of trade unions around the world. But Kashmir's our trade union movement started 15 years before that. We had a shawl weavers protest, which was sort of a trade union in the 1800s, which protested against high taxes which were imposed by the Maharaja. So it was probably one of the first trade union movements around the world. And there's a tremendous history to the rights that we have earned for ourselves after years of struggle and where we could contextualize them in global struggles.
Thank you very much for being on All the Rage, solidarity in your work. And thank you so much for introducing us to the history and the present day of a region which is badly covered by our media, I think we can agree. Yeah. Thanks for your time, mate.
Thanks a lot.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.